Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. I'm your host, Tom Scholt from the University of British Columbia. On this episode, we'll be talking to Anthimos Alexandros Tsirigotis about his book, Cybernetics, Warfare and Discourse, The Cybernetization of Warfare in Britain, out from Springer in 2017. Given the significant efforts of the field's founder, Norbert Wiener, to distance cybernetics from military research and application, as well as the ethical stances of some of the field's later leading lights, such as Heinz von Förster, Humberto Maturana, Herbert Brunn, Ranulf Glanville, and Larry Richards, it should not be surprising if some contemporary cyberneticians might find the particular combination of words in this book's title somewhat disconcerting. However, far from producing a strictly first-order technological study or strategic how-to manual, Greek military officer Tsirigotis has carried out a decidedly second-order examination of the subject that supplants the mainstream assumption of cyberspace as a set of technologies with a notion of cyberspace as a set of social practices produced and reproduced autopoietically through what he calls cyber discourse. Grounded in notions of emergence and complexity and employing digital tools of corpus linguistics on policy documents from over the past seven decades, Tsirigotis traces the transformation of such notions as security and threat in British military circles. The result is a conception of the state not as a particular bounded geographical region, but as a network of autopoietic social practices, and of a world in which such states do not seek to extinguish external threats through the deployment of hard military power, rather seek to use their networks to adapt to the constant presence of threats in their environment. Along the way, Tsirigotis provides a striking example of what a truly second-order social science, capable of engaging with all manner of social practices beyond the military sphere, might look like. Anthimos Tsirigotis, welcome to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling me.
You bet. The first thing we always do on New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, as we do on all the channels on the New Books Network, is to have the author tell us a little bit about themselves, your academic background, some of your trajectory, maybe where you're at now, and how you came to be engaged with the field of cybernetics.
All right, Tom. I have a rather different academic trajectory because I have finished Air Force Academy, so I'm a military officer. I have some postgraduate studies, my master's degree, on international relations, and then my PhD at the University of Reading in the UK on politics and international relations. So my PhD was on cyber warfare. My initial research question was on cyber warfare. Today, I don't have an academic trajectory because since I've finished my PhD, I still work for the military in Greece, but always trying to move into academia, maybe on research project. So my theme was, as I've said, on cyber warfare. And when I was doing my research, so my initial thoughts were different. But at some point, I came through cybernetics, which I found it a really pertinent theory for my theme. And I used it in order to give some different answers on the main field, why or if states can use cyber weapons to wage their wars. Because there is, and there is still is, a debate on if these kind of weapons are potent enough, if they can be used for waging wars without the need for the states to mobilize their traditional armies. I mean, aircraft, naval forces, or ground forces. I thought that this was a rather unproductive way to see the whole debate. And with my book and my PhD, I wanted to propose another way to answer this theme. And I used cybernetics in order to go back and give another idea of what cyberspace is. I used cybernetics in order to see the roots of this idea and to see what was the main idea and what how this was transferred to the real world. I mean, for example, the internet or the cyber weapons. So cyberspace for me, it's not the internet. It's not the internet used for military purpose. But for me, cyberspace and cyber warfare is another way to see the real world. And how this is transferred to warfare, it's by means of discourse, which changes the way the states understand the problem of war. I mean, how they understand why they should wage wars, for what reasons, and by using what means. And cybernetics and the way cybernetics propose the way we understand the real world, I propose with my book that this has changed the way some states, my case study was the United Kingdom, understand and wage their wars. So I used the discourse in order to trace these changes throughout some decades and to see how the meaning of war in the UK has changed in another, and it has changed in the same way that cybernetics theories understand the social world.
Thank you, Antimos. Yes, that sets us up nicely. It's really quite an astonishing book and not at all what I expected when I first came across the title. Although once I read the description that you were going to, I mean, obviously discourse, the word discourse is in the title, but the title perhaps might lead one to believe that this is going to be a strictly kind of first order cybernetic engagement of the hows and procedures of quote unquote cyber war, but in fact it really is operating on a second order cybernetic level in terms of the constructivist angle on the construction of reality through the concepts we use and the way this feedback loop between how we describe the world becomes the world we live in and then becomes the world we act on, and then that feeds back into our descriptions. And it really is a stunningly deeply cybernetic exercise, so that cybernetics is not only the topic of the book but is in fact the kind of procedure that you're using. And it even echoes, again, second order cybernetics and even what has recently been called second order science in the work of Carl Mueller and others, talking about a sort of science of science, because of this type of discourse analysis that you use, gathering a large corpus of writings and then using certain analytical tools to discover how they are in fact, producing the very reality that they purport to describe. But we'll get to that and to the methodologies, some of the methodologies that you used as we go along. But this book manages to be cybernetic on a number of levels at once, which really made it quite a surprising and kind of an astonishing read for me. So congratulations on this very complex work. So thank you. Yeah. So we often find, or I often find that in doing these interviews, if the title of a book has a number of terms sort of in a row, it's sometimes useful to, particularly when it's as dense and the material is as complex and layered as is the case in your book, it's useful to sort of go through the terms that appear in the title. So Cybernetics Warfare Discourse, the main title. So you've said a little bit about this, but can you tell me, tell our listeners, you know, in a sense, which cybernetics are you talking about? Because it's such a vast field, and anyone who's been to a cybernetics conference knows that you can spend days us continuing to define the field itself. But what is it, your understanding of cybernetics that you're applying to this book and to this analysis? And I know that it hinges a lot on emergence, complexity, and some of those ideas. So can you just say a bit about the cybernetics in the title of your book?
First of all, I'm not a really expert on cybernetics. I came through these theories trying to give answers to my research questions. So the way that I have used this theory is that I have found very useful the ideas of autopsies, complexity, for my work, because it gives it's really useful for the way that used in social sciences. I mean, on the one hand, we have a really complex social world, especially nowadays. So these ideas on cybernetics have given me useful ways to understand the social world. So in a very complex, and especially in nowadays that we have all these information systems and everyone is connected, and the actions can very easily disperse on the social world. So because the really traditional way that politics and international theories on international relations understand warfare was not useful for my purposes. When I started my research on cyber warfare, I was trying to give answers on whether cyber weapons could cause harm and make enemies to follow our wills. But I found myself really in a difficult position to answer this kind of question. So I changed the way I see the social world and reality on warfare. And it was then that cybernetics came in the whole picture and helped me to understand that and to propose that this is not a productive way to understand modern warfare. The ideas of complexity, for example, the idea of the information loops, so helped me to give different answers to the problematization of warfare. So it was then that do you want to continue with discourse and how I used the discourse to this? All right.
Well, actually, I'd like to follow up just with a couple of details about cybernetics, and then we can move on to discourse, if that's okay. So particularly autopoiesis, tell me a little bit about that concept and how it's been useful for your, as you say, very changed understanding or a notion of the social world.
It was the way that I give answers on how social systems manage to go on and to continue be alive. I mean, how they give answers to the way they understand their problems and the way they evolve through time. This This was for societies and states. If they want to continue to be alive, they should find new ways to understand what happens around them. And for example, I have found that the way, for example, they understand what threat is or how security is understood, they have changed the way they see, they understand all these ideas in order to continue be to be alive. And this is the way that I transfer the idea of autopsies to my work for the social systems.
So yeah, the literally, of course, the literal meaning of the word of self-creating, that the society continues to reproduce itself through its own communications. If you're looking at it from the perspective of Nicholas Luhmann, or it creates itself through its own elements, and that it needs to continue to do that to maintain its existence. Is that fair?
Yeah. And in order to do this, they have to reconceptualize continuously what happens around them. I mean, the real world. That's why they don't have the same ideas throughout their whole living time.
So the relationship of the system to its environment, and the way that it understands and cognizes that environment, is a changing thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Great. And yes, let's move on to discourse.
And so discourse is how, in practical, let's say, terms, all these ideas are transferred to the real world. Through discourse, for example, they give meaning to what happens, and they give meaning and they give new meanings to old ideas, because warfare is deep-rooted idea. So through discourse and social practices, they give new meanings to why warfare should be waged and how states should wage their wars, and for what reasons. In my case, the UK, I used some written policy documents as an instance of discourse, the written language, I mean, and I have tried to trace changes in the way words were used in order each time to mean different things for the same old ideas, such as military forces or military power.
And can you say a little bit about the methodology you use to analyze this discourse? Because again, one of the ways in which this book is, many ways in which this book and this whole project of yours is cybernetic, is the kind of analysis technology software you used to run various analyses on this discourse. So can you say a little bit about your methodology?
Right. Yes. This comes from the field of corpus linguistics, which uses some software in order to analyze a corpus of written language, of texts. After processing these texts and you feed them on the system, on the software, then you're trying to trace, I tried to trace some semantic changes. I mean, some changes in the way the meaning of the word is changing. Because, you know, each time we say, for example, warfare or power, military power, policymakers were not meaning the same thing. So in practical terms, I used two software, WMatrix and I don't remember the other the name of the other one.
We can find it in the book.
Yeah, of course. in order to trace these changes, it's not an automated way. You don't feed the software and you have your answers, because as it happens with all quantitative research methods, you have to translate these findings. So it's not a very straightforward process.
And some of the things they look at are the proximity of words to each other and as ways to indicate, right? So that kind of context, etc. And so the shifting terminologies, shifting understandings of security, power, warfare, and other words that you focused on.
Threats.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You use the collocations as it is the term in order you examine which words were used in the vicinity of your target word. So if the target word is, for example, threat, I traced all the collocations by that meaning all the words used, five words to the left and five words to the right of the target word threat. Because, you know, the way you use the other words with your target word with the threat, this gives meanings to the main word, to the threat. It seems difficult, but it's not. For example, let's say nowadays we have the problem with the climate change, and we have some threats concerning this kind of threats coming from the climate change. I mean, some decades before they were not using any words related to the climate. So that means that there is a change to what the threat is, for example. So I have traced all these collocations in order to see how the meaning of my main words, threat, security, has changed.
And you essentially coin the term cyber discourse, and you are suggesting, as you've said in this interview as well, that you found it unproductive to think of cyberspace as a kind of material place or a set of material objects, whether it's computers and software, hardware, etc., but rather that there is something that you call cyber discourse that in fact creates the conditions for this whole thing we call cyberspace. So can you say a little bit about what are the main features of what you're identifying as cyber discourse?
Yeah, this is the main point of my work, and what I suggest is that it's really unproductive to have an army, let's say, to have your military forces equipped with all these tools, the cyber tools, if this army does not have the mentality of waging war by means of cyberspace. So I propose that there is cyber discourse, and I equate this cyber discourse with the way that a sovereign state understands the problematization of war. I mean, why this state should wage war, for what reasons, and how. So for military forces, they have to have both of them. They must have the mentality of cyber warfare, and they must have the tools for waging this kind of war. Or of warfare. It's unproductive to have all the tools to protect your networks and to say that you are ready to wage cyber warfare if you have an understanding of what a threat, a military threat is, or of what military power is by following the old-fashioned way. So to put it in another way, for a state, if the policymakers understand threats to binary code, I mean they identify threats to the if the way they identify their threats, it's not the same within the cyber discourse, because, for example, within the cyber discourse, sovereign states they don't see threats as they have to extinguish them. Through my research, I have found that the UK has changed the way they have understood what the threat is and the way they should relate with their threats. So nowadays, the states that have the cyber discourse and they follow the cyber discourse, they see threats as a new way to relate with them in order to impose their will. They don't consider that they have to extinguish them. They find new ways and other ways in order to relate with them and to make them change the way that this threat see their own states. So this is another way that they use their military power, not in order to extinguish what threatens their nations, but as a way to impose their will. And this is a huge change in terms of meaning, in terms of how they understand and what meaning they give to their threats and to how they should use their military forces. I know that maybe this sounds a little bit strange because still these days we still have wars in the traditional meaning. But my work proposes another way to understand cyber warfare and to distinguish between the way cyber warfare is waged and the way it is understood as a new discourse, giving meaning to the new reality of warfare.
Which seems to spring, of course, from coming out of the cyber discourse, a new conception of the living, in a sense, that, you know, if you're going to go back to notions of autopoiesis, you know, that obviously come from Maturana and Varela, this idea of this of an organism in its environment, and you're talking about a kind of a different conception of the organism's relationship to its environment, and that rather than projecting power or this idea of geographical space defining what a nation is, but more about the social practices that embody that nation through their enactment, and then its relationship to its environment through the many networks in which it is embedded. Is that correct?
It's exactly this way that I propose. That's why I have proposed this cyber discourse as produced by the theories of cybernetics. This way to understand the real world, the modern world.
Great. So, so we obviously have all these tools, though, that are known in the popular discourse as, you know, the sort of, you know, that the prefix cyber becomes, you know, detached from its initial meaning in the word kibernetes of steersman, and becomes just associated with computers, etc. So cyber discourse, I'm sensing then, eventually does give birth to a kind of thinking that enables the development of certain types of technology. And of course, the early cybernetics were involved in the development of technologies. Second order cybernetics gets more into the ideas, more self-reflexive ideas of cognition, etc. And you're using those ideas, it seems to me. But also that, so my question is, it's one of these chicken or the egg kinds of questions, because of course, in cybernetics, it's all about these loops and these cycles. But is there a sense that the cyber discourse, beginning all the way back, you know, in the Macy conferences, and of course, even earlier, if you go back to some sort of proto-cybernetic thinkers like Bogdanov and Ampere, et cetera, but this idea, these ideas of feedback, the relationship of organism and environment, et cetera, changes a conception of life that manages to sort of permeate various areas of human activity, leading to technological innovations, so that this conception of life has changed all of these practices, including technological practices, and created this reality that then is sort of fed back into itself.
And this is really relevant today with the new technologies such as artificial intelligence, for example, which is another way that all these theories are given meaning, and they find new expressions in technology, and I think that this is a really fascinating new field. I mean, artificial intelligence, and a new way that we understand our lives as well and our boundaries as well, because we have artificial intelligence and the way that new assemblages are created between technology and humans. And we as well as humans, we redefine and we see ourselves through these assemblages in a new way. So all this, what I've said, cyber discourse, can have more expressions in new technologies. As I've said, we redefine our boundaries and how we understand our lives and how we interact with these new technologies. And To have these new expressions, you have to change the way you understand the words. That's why I have traced changes in my case only what concerns warfare, but we can trace more changes in the social world that can give birth to all these new ideas of how we live our lives within assemblages of humans and artificial intelligence. I mean that these theories are really relevant today, and policymakers as well should be really aware of all these things, because as you have said, it's not only cyber, it's not a prefix, it's a whole new idea of how social world is organized today.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the shifts you found. As you mentioned, the UK is your test case in a sense, and as reflected in the subtitle of the book. So what are some of the evolutions of words like threat and warfare and security that you were able to trace through this corpus linguistics approach to all these different documents that come from different genres that you've identified of sort of government documents around security and policy, etc.?
Yeah. So the first change, it was about security discourse. So I have found that through the years, policymakers, initially they were concerned about defense. So what you could find in those documents back in the 60s or 70s, it was the defense discourse, how they should defend the UK against their enemies. And those enemies back in those days were tangible enemies. They had specific identifications. But later, little by little, we have the emergence of a new discourse. It was the security discourse. And policymakers were talking more and more about not defense, but about security, how they should make the UK secure, a secure place for their nation, for people to thrive. So that was the first specific semantic change, how policymakers in a corpus, mainly consisting of military documents. I mean, my corpus was only had documents only policy of national defense and security. So it was really interesting to see these change, how little by little they stopped talking about defense and they were constructing a new discourse, the security discourse. And for this discourse, they had to reconceive the way they were understanding threats. And here comes the second semantic change. The threat, it was not only a tangible threat, a threat with a specific identification, but the threat was conceived little by little as a challenge. So the policymakers were conceiving constructing new meaning of threats as challenges, and they should find ways to address, to live with these challenges. So nowadays, policymakers are not concerned only to to extinguish these threats, but they are more concerned how to use military forces in order to continue to be resilient, as they say, to continue living with the presence of threats. So the main point for them is not to have a safe and secure nation as it was some decades before, but nowadays it is how to continue be alive, and here comes the theory of cybernetics, how to be alive through an environment inherently insecure. And then the final change is how they use and how they conceive military power. As I have said initially, they were constructing a meaning of military power as a way to distract, to cause destruction, and that was this was the target. But nowadays, the meaningful change concerns that military power is not only is not mainly a way to distract, but it's a way to make enemies, to change the way they are thinking, to make them change the way they understand the UK, not in a hostile way, but to make them come with the British way of thinking. So these were the changes that I have traced through my corpus, and they can be seen in the genre of how policymakers come together in order to write the new policy document.
And you've also talked about how individual citizens of the UK and other states that might be operating within this cyber discourse that you talk about have a different role to play, or are conceived of differently in this new relationship you're describing, which is about adapting in such a way that one can live with threats within the environment, as opposed to this idea of extinguishing threats. But it changes the role of citizens as agents of the state, for to use that term. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is very interesting. Some decades before, initially, in my corpus, the citizens, the British citizens, were not considered as agents, they were not considered as a way to keep the nation safe. Little by little, this has changed, and they are nowadays considered as critical loops for the security chain. To put it differently, they are considered co-responsible with the nation, with policymakers, with the government, co-responsible for keeping their nation safe. And this can be seen with the case of any incident in cyberspace. So we are asked to keep ourselves safe by ourselves within the cyberspace. So we have all these centers that inform us about the dangers and how we should keep ourselves safe. So you see that they consider us as agents of actions in this governmental effort to keep the nation safe. And this can be seen not only in the case of the social practice of writing policies concerning warfare and security, but also citizens nowadays are considered co-responsible for a series of other things, for keeping themselves, for example, healthy. For many life companies, they are asking some categories of people, some groups of people, to have a healthy way of living in order to offer them some kind of protection, security, life contracts. So this is an idea that finds expressions to other social practices as well, and not only within the practice of social security. Of defense and national security.
Yes, and you talk about just the, you know, if we're talking this cyber discourse about the identity of a system and the nation as a kind of social system with an identity, it seems that, and I picked this up, I believe, in the book, that it's not even just the practices that are can be directly traced to notions of security, but the various social practices, particularly a country like Great Britain. I mean, there are particular social practices that those of us outside of Britain would consider to be quintessentially British, for instance, and that in a sense, it's the maintenance of the ability to continue those social practices, which are then recreated, of course, through continuous communications, again, to use the Nicholas Luhmann's perspective of that social autopoiesis. But it's about being able to maintain that sense of the identity of the nation not being as concretely understood as the territory, but as the social practices themselves. And what is it that makes us British? And how do we continue to navigate our relationship with our environment in such a way that we can continue those practices that constitute Britishness itself. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, exactly. It's the British way of living, but the way that they define British, their territory, as you said, not only related to a specific space, but to a specific way of understanding the real world. So this is the British way. And this is translated within social practices, which in different points of time, they give different interpretations of the world.
You also mentioned that the decline of Britain's place on the world stage as a world power following the Second World War and renegotiating, in a sense, what the word great means in the term Great Britain, not just great as in large, but, you know, wherein lies the greatness of Britain, so to speak, and that those renegotiations have played a role also in this reassessment of security and what the priorities and procedures of the British military would be. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, here comes the debate about what has the primary role. I mean, discourse or actual practices, the real acts, the real facts of life. I tried to be realistic, let's say, and not to give space to the idea that says that it's not only discourse, it's not only cyber discourse that changed, that it has changed the way the UK, for example, now understands the world, but it was a whole series of actual things, of actual facts that have changed the world. So yes, of course, it was the end of for the Cold War, a major historical fact. It's not only that maybe has made policymakers to see the world in a different way. So, I mean, I tried to hear the criticism and the feedback that I've got on my work, because each time I have presented my theory, my work, my project in my department, which is really hardly realistic, it was of realism, I had this criticism that, okay, it's discourse, the way you explain the how policymakers give meaning to the world, but here we have some actual facts. But as I mentioned in my work, and here comes critical realism, but it's not only the facts, these facts are given meaning through social practices and discourse. It's really difficult to find the happy medium between discourse and actual fact realism. But I tried to give voice to this kind of criticism on my work. And of course, I say that, yes, it was some major historical fact that have placed some role to the emergence of cyber discourse. But on the other hand, it was not these historical facts have been made not out of the blue. It was also a series of other social practices that help them to happen.
Right. I'm glad you got a chance to mention critical realism as well, because that obviously plays a role as a kind of mediating force between the sort of constructivist view you're looking at and a more realist historical approach, perhaps. And of course, we've been able to cover some things about critical realism on this podcast, an interview with John Mingers that I encourage our listeners to find in the archive if they haven't had a chance to hear it.
Yeah,
Mingers is a very important thinker in that realm. So you've mentioned being in your department and being a military officer and not primarily an academic, who started with a set of questions, and then in the discovery of cybernetics and cyber discourse, It changed your perspective and changed even your questions and introduced this sort of streak of constructivism into your thinking that perhaps, if I'm hearing you correctly, sets you slightly at odds with some of the colleagues in the domains in which you usually work. So can you say a word about if and how this your own personal cybernetization, if I can call it that, has changed your perspective and your own relationship to your own career as a military officer and to your own world in which you operate as an agent?
All right. Very, very interesting question. My own cybernization. Okay. So I think that with these theories, I have found my own expression, but they have not changed the way me as a person, I see the world. Let's put it in another way. I've always been thinking in a cyber way, but I didn't know that. I mean that I tried to answer my initial research questions in a realistic way of working. But as a person, I've always been a person of critical realism, and I was trying to say that it's the way we see the world, the way that we give answers to the world. So with cybernetics theories, this gave me a useful tool to express myself. It has not changed me as a person or as a military officer, but it was a really useful theory for me to say, yes, that's the way I'm thinking, and to express myself. In practical terms, in my work, it's very difficult to apply this because I don't have the power to do it. But in the future, if I manage to move into academia, I think this is the way that I would like to follow and to understand, as I've already said, phenomena such as assemblages created by humans and artificial intelligence.
Well, it'll certainly be interesting to watch as you move through continuing your professional trajectory and to see if as these ideas perhaps proliferate and infiltrate other areas of discourse, what impacts they might have. One of the things that this book does, I think, that is really useful is and is offers promise to the entire field of cybernetics and systems is demonstrating a kind of second order scientific method through which various areas of social practice might be examined through this lens of cyber discourse. And the book kind of ends with suggesting that, you know, military is one field of application that might be analyzed, but that perhaps there are others. Can you say a little bit about what you hope and think maybe the future of this type of analysis might be within the wider field of social sciences?
Yeah, I really think that this is a really promising research tool for social scientists. I believe that social scientists are in front of a big dilemma because they have to open their perspectives and find new tools, new research tools to understand what happens. I mean, they are not so much familiar with, let's say, big data analysis or complex systems theory. I find these areas of knowledge really useful. For social sciences, as I said, in the area of artificial intelligence, because now there is a huge realm of work on how policymakers should address matters of privacy. Let's say privacy is another major concern. How we understand what our private area. And with all these new technologies, our privacy is really should be redefined. And cybernetics and second order cybernetics is about exactly this. And social scientists should use this theory in order to explain how these boundaries, how as we as living systems redefine our boundaries. And of course, cybernetics theory and especially second order, as you said, they have much to say on this field.
Thank you. I hope that's something that second order cyberneticians who might be listening to this might take away from this, because there are bound to be those in the second order cybernetics community who are always uncomfortable when cybernetics and military matters are spoken of together. Again, because the field of cybernetics has spent a lot of time, and all the way back to Norbert Wiener, its founder, who was very concerned with the use of cybernetics in military research. Cybernetics has spent a lot of time trying to make clear that it is not a techno-military science in and of itself. And I'm hoping that something that all of our listeners and members of the community can take from your book is it, as well as being an analysis of the military, which is the place where you've chosen to spend your life and your work, also as an example of a very useful, an example of the way that second-order cybernetics could perhaps once again become a robust and utilized framework for social analysis, which I think the book has done an admirable job of demonstrating how that works.
Yeah, we have to find ways to coexist. Cyberneticians and the social scientists, they have to find new ways, both of them, to coexist and to give answers. Yeah, exactly.
So you've mentioned that you are don't have a permanent home in academia. You continue your active career as a military officer in Greece. What's next for you in terms of your career or your study or any other writing projects you might have? What's next on the horizon for you?
Yeah, I'm always searching for new research projects, and I apply for as a lecturer. But still with no luck. It's really difficult if you lead a professional life as a military and you are trying to change. It's really difficult because you have your life, your everyday life and your dream. For me, my dream is academia. So I'm trying to find my way between my dream and my reality.
Well, we certainly wish you the best of luck with that, and I'm going to be fascinated to keep an eye on where you travel and what other writing you may produce down the road as you take these new insights you've had about again from this very second order cybernetic perspective, these new reflections that you have. You say they've helped you find a voice for some intuitions that you've always had, but of course, in true cybernetic fashion, these new descriptions of the world and your world that you're making will feed back into the world that you see and that you continue to act upon. So we wish you the best of luck and hope that we have a chance to talk to you about some future work again down the road. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for spending the time with us. You've been very generous with your time. You're very welcome. We've been talking to Anthimos Tsirigotis about his book, Cybernetics, Warfare, and Discourse. Thank you very much for joining us.